of any leader, any elected leader in any country of Europe. Russia has learned from its mistakes. And President Putin is one of those who's learned from his mistakes. Learning from your mistakes is happening on the battlefield all the time since February 2022. It is happening on the Russian side on the battlefield. It's happening on the Russian side strategically. Russia has made fundamental mistakes since the United States helped put Boris Yeltsin into power in 91.
Well, in the context of war, and as you were mentioning, the terrible casualty figures, it's a pretty tough environment for trial and error, that's for sure. John, we'll have to break off here. I look forward to our next conversation. Things are only going to ratchet it up, I feel, from here anyway. But thanks a lot, John, for coming on, eh?
Thank you very much for having me, Chris. Look forward to next time.
Of course, and thanks to stay tuned, everybody, because Dave Lindorf is coming straight up in the second half. Thanks again, John.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire, fire.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, America has been at war with Russia much longer than most people today appreciate. In 1944, though allies in the fight against the Axis powers, the United States planned, after Hitler's fall, to turn its super-secret super-weapon, the A-bomb, on its friend, the Soviet Union, killing tens of millions of its people and crippling its society. The plan was to send Russia back to the Stone Age. And the plan may have succeeded, but for the Soviets' miraculous development of its own superweapon, promising any such action against it would provoke a mutual response. Mutually assured destruction, the MAD doctrine, has been with us, hanging over the heads of us all at varying degrees of imminent catastrophe ever since. But how did the Soviets manage their miracle of atomic deterrence? Dave Lindorf is an Izzy Award-winning investigative journalist, author, founder of the news website ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, and documentary producer whose now released film, A Compassionate Spy, tells the tale of Ted Hall, wunderkind physicist and spy who may well have saved Russia and the world from nuclear conflagration. Dave's been working on a companion book of sorts for the film titled Spy for No Country, due out any day. Welcome back to the program, Dave.
Well, thanks for having me on, Chris.
Well, it's always my pleasure. You know that. And well, Dave, in my introduction, I say that this that your book, Spy for No Country, is a sort of companion piece for the film, A Compassionate Spy. But that's not quite right, is it? Tell me, what is? How do you see the film and the film's, or the book, rather, in the book's role?
Well, I guess I have to look at the genesis of this thing, which is that I got to know Joan because I wrote this piece about Ted, who I discovered in the act of trying to do a memorial on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and thought I'd look up the spies who were in the Los Alamos project to try to get a new angle to write about. And I discovered this, acne-plagued young, teenager who was the youngest spy in the Los Alamos project and had become a spy because of feeling that the U.S. coming out of the war with a monopoly on the bomb would be a disaster for the world. So he gave the Russians, the Soviets, the plans and everything for the plutonium bomb he was working on. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. And I found out he had never been busted. So I wanted to do a book on it right away. I mean, I was thinking, wow, nobody's really done this, which turned out to be not true. There was a book done in 97 that's quite good called Bombshell, but it didn't get much attention. But I had the benefit of, they didn't have access to the FBI files because he hadn't died yet, and they didn't have the access to what the U.S. bombing plans were, which I had been learning about. for bombing the Soviet Union preemptively. So, you know, then and then what opened things up for me was I got a letter out of the blue from Joan Hall saying, you know, "Dear Dave, I'm reading your article in Counterpunch about Ted Hall. I'm his with tears in my eyes. I'm his widow. And we need to talk," you know. So we got to be friends on email, and she lived in Cambridge, England, and I, you know, eventually got to meet her with my wife, became really good friends, and you know, I said I wanted to do a book on Ted, and I said it's time. It's 20 years later since the Bombshell book, and I think a lot of the story, a lot more is known about the story and the importance of what Ted did. And she said she didn't want a book because she didn't want to be, you know, hounded by the British press as they had been when Ted was exposed in 1995 by the release of the Venona spy cables, Soviet spy cables that identified him as a spy. And so I said, okay. And I just, you know, figured, okay, I guess I won't do that book. And then a year later, she called me and said that she had been hoping that this drama would be done of it by a film company in England, and they had given up because they couldn't get funding. And she just said, "I wish you could do a film." And, you know, I thought I could, but it would be a dry political film, and I don't know how to raise money, and I wouldn't know how to get it distributed, so it would just sort of disappear. But I was going to do it. And then I thought of going to Steve James, who I knew because of the Abacus movie that he did that I was used in as a reporter to explain the national significance of the story. And I pitched it to Steve and his usual producer, and they decided it could be done. And I became a producer on it. And so that's the movie. But meanwhile, I was going to do the book, damn it, you know, because that was my original plan. And I figured, you know, okay, well, if Joan can go for the movie with me as the producer and trust me, you know, she can trust me for the book. So I told her I'm going to do a book, and she was okay with it at that point. So so I started, you know, fortunately, you know, I got a $47,500 producer's fee for the movie, which basically became my research money for the book, because everything I was doing for the movie, you know, lining up interviews and, you know, and keeping Joan happy and all of that was going towards doing interviews for the book. And I did a lot more interviews for the book. And so and now the book is coming out. The timing is fantastic because they've now moved up the publication date for the book, and it's coming out on the 24th of October. And I'll be getting review copies of it at the last week of September.
Well, why is that a good thing that it's coming out in October instead of November?
Well, it was going to come out December 5th, and I told my editor and the acquisitions editor, who also edited the book, Jake Bonar, really good guy. I said, "Jake, you know, it's almost never does a book have a movie promoting it." I said, "None of us expected this movie to do well because, you know, how many movies are there that say that an American spy for the Soviet Union who gave them the atomic bomb did the right thing? This movie says that." And, you know, we just thought, you know, this will never go anywhere in the United States. And, you know, a lot of stars aligned right because, you know, we're getting great reviews on it, even in the mainstream press, amazingly. The New York Times gave it a great review. USA Today gave it a stellar review. It got a 5-star review in The Guardian. So, you know, that's fantastic publicity for the book. And I said, but if the book comes out in December, that'll be sort of past the peak interest in this movie, I would assume. And so we'll have missed it. And he said, "You're right. I'm gonna press the printer to bump us up in the queue for getting this book printed. And then he announced later, you know, after a week after that, that they'd agreed to move it up to October 24th.
Well, I'm surprised, Dave, to hear that you're getting, I mean, not that you're getting great reviews, but that some of those reviews are coming from sources that are still politically mired. I mean, anybody that opens a paper or watches TV knows that the mood towards Russia, although your story is about the Soviets, it's still Russia. And I don't think there's a lot of people that can distinguish nowadays between the two. They seem to roll them into one. But that the political element of the current moment hasn't hampered the way the story of the previous moment is being covered in the press there.
No, I mean, it's really it's a tribute to Steve James and the way he couched the movie as a love story. And it is a love story between Ted and his wife of 51 years, Joan Hall, who kept that secret with him. She was never a spy, by the way. She got to know him in 1947 when he was at Chicago, University of Chicago, working on his doctorate in physics, and they fell in love and he married her. And you know, but told her, you know, there's something I got to tell you first before you say yes. You know, so she agreed that she wanted to marry him regardless of what he had done. In fact, she told me it even made her want to marry him more because, you know, it was a heroic act that he did.
And well, when you say that, Dave, I mean, yeah, it's easy for us now in hindsight to say that. But as you were just saying, the fact of America, as I mentioned in the introduction, the fact that America planned to drop up to 300 nuclear bombs, 400 on a defenseless Russia in this unprovoked attack to take them back to the Stone Age, Ted couldn't have known that when he made his decision, or did he?
Absolutely not. But he was prescient enough to know that a country that had an absolute monopoly on the bomb was going to abuse it. And you know, he was proven right by what the U.S. did, the atrocity it committed on Japan with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, two bombs that did not need to be dropped. And if you, even if you accept the false argument that was used that was to save American lives, it didn't need to be dropped the way it was dropped. You know, those bombs were dropped with the intent of killing as many people as possible. They were dropped in the morning, and especially the Hiroshima one, which was a total shock to the Japanese. They didn't know that such a thing existed, and they dropped it at 8 o'clock in the morning. Why would they do that? Because everybody was out on the street, including kids going to school. They wanted a maximum death toll because they wanted to show the power of destruction of the hydrogen bomb, of the atomic bomb. And who are they showing it to? They didn't need to show it to Japan. Japan was on its knees and suing for peace while the U.S. was ignoring it. And the people they wanted to show were Russia's leaders, and especially Stalin. This is going to happen to you if you mess with us and don't do what we want. And yeah, there's no question about it. The people, you know, all the apologists are completely full of it. Eisenhower said the bomb shouldn't have been dropped, and he said he argued against dropping it right before they did it. So when Stinson told them it was going to happen, he said, we should not do that. We'll be condemned by the world. It'll be terrible, and we don't need to do it. And he said, they told them, I know that the Japanese are suing for peace, and all they need is a face-saving way to do it. Mm-hmm. We wanted to drop those bombs, and there was a huge pressure on the people in Los Alamos who were building the plutonium and the hydrogen bomb that were used to get the damn things done and get them on planes and ships and get them into Tinian Island so they could be launched against Japan before the war ended. There's also really good evidence that I give in the book that they actually got the negotiator for Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists who were negotiating through in Russia with the Japanese for an end to the war in China, to delay, because they wanted to be able to use the bombs. I mean, this is really criminal. And you know, and this stuff did come out because, you know, the guys that were building the bomb at Los Alamos, they knew that they were being pushed. And they also knew that Japan was, you know, dead in the water at that point.
And the Russian counteroffensive in China, as I recall, was the very same day as the Hiroshima bomb was dropped. If it was Hiroshima or Nagasaki, but this major Russian push against the Japanese forces in China coincided.
That's not a coincidence. You know, this is another thing that Americans don't know. But at Yalta, Roosevelt really wanted the Russians to join the war against Japan. Through the entire war of World War II, the entire war, the Soviet Union had a non-aggression treaty in place with the Japanese. So in other words, they declared war on, you know, when Hitler invaded Russia, Russia obviously declared war on Germany, but they didn't. You know, like the U.S. Immediately after Pearl Harbor declared war on Japan and its ally, Nazi Germany. In the Russians' case, when the Germans invaded Russia, they did not declare war on Japan. They didn't want a two-front war. And all through the war, they didn't fight the Japanese. But they agreed in Yalta. Roosevelt got them to say they would join the fight against Japan in 90 days after Germany surrendered, whenever that would be. They all knew it was coming. And he said he needed 90 days to ship the Red Army troops over to eastern Siberia near the Manchurian border, and to move on the Trans-Siberian Railway all the, you know, the heavy equipment that they would need to attack the Japanese army. So this was all planned, and that's when the 90 days were up. We accused Stalin of showing, you know, his aggressive desire to conquer the world by invading Japan at the end of the war, but that wasn't true. What he was doing was complying with what he had agreed to do in the Yalta Agreement.
Six is nine historically. Once again, what a surprise. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dave Lindorf. Dave's an Izzy Award-winning investigative journalist and author, founder of the web news site ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. Well, then the compassion that Ted possessed, this self-sacrifice. I mean, he didn't know that he wouldn't be caught. He could have been caught at any moment. But why do you think that he took those risks?
He said that he was asked in that CNN BBC interview, and we used the segment in it. They said, the reporter said, "Ted, why did you do it?" And he goes, "You know, like, whoa." And he, you know, and he said, "I didn't expect that one." And so he said, he thought for a while, and then he says, "Well, I guess I'd say compassion." And then he said, "That's a stab at it." And, you know, it came out of the blue. And you know, my wife and the other producer in the film, Mark Mitten, both said, that's the title. We'd been stewing over what the title would be. And Joan would disagree with everything. And, you know, Steve had a whole bunch of ideas that none of us liked. And you know, then Mark and Joyce looked at that and just both said, "That's the title of the film," and Steve agreed, so it became A Compassionate Spy. But he was talking about the Russian people and the people of the world, because he was convinced, and I think absolutely correctly, that if the U.S. had had a free hand with the bomb for the 10 years that it was predicting it would take the Russians to get it, that they were going to use it. And, you know, the history of the U.S. use of the bomb, both in Japan and the massive killing that U.S. military has done since the war. I think by one account, 6 million people have died in U.S. Military actions since World War II. And most of those were killed in massive carpet bombings of North Korea during the Korean War. So they dropped so many bombs, the U.S., on North Korea during that war, that on North Korea, that the bombers were flying back towards their bases in Japan and dropping their bombs in the ocean because they couldn't find any targets to drop them on, and they didn't want to land with a full, you know, load of bombs. And believe me, they would have much rather been doing that job with nukes, because it would have been a lot simpler. And then in Vietnam, another 3 million people were killed by most of it by carpet bombing and by napalm bombs dropped from the air. We had a much more efficient way to have done it, which we couldn't use because the Soviets had the bomb. And believe me, we would have. Anybody who thinks that the U.S. is not a bloodthirsty military society is just ignoring all the facts on the ground.
Well, and in the Vietnam, those bombers during that war, the ones returning to base with targets unreached or already destroyed, were dropping their bombs not in the ocean, but on Cambodia and Laos.
On Cambodia and Laos and dikes in Vietnam, in North Vietnam, everywhere. They're B-52s. They were using B-52s over Cambodia and Laos. I went to Laos and I saw areas that were just craters. They had so many bombs dropped that when you go into Vientiane, as I did, and walk around, you see, and you walk into an office of a government or a bank or something, the ashtrays that they use, you know, those things with sand in them that you can snuff out your butt in, are the bottom halves of 500-pound bombs that where the round part on the top has been sawed off, and they're standing on their tails with sand in them. I mean, it's sickening that it was done to a country like Laos.
Dave, we're fast running out of time. But before reiterating the essentials that our listeners need to know to both see the film A Compassionate Spy and to access your book, Spy for No Country, set for release October 24th, here we are today. Now, the full spectrum dominance that the United States has always wished for now is the prize that they are going to extraordinary lengths to reestablish, or to establish as fully as they can do since the fall of the Soviets in the late 20th century. What's your take on the zeitgeist right now in America regarding these more and more outlandish acts of aggression by the government there?
By this government?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, look, they keep escalating the weapons that they're giving to the Ukrainian army, that now they're going to give them depleted uranium shells that'll litter the landscape with uranium oxide that will go into people's lungs and that'll be ingested in food that will irradiate their bodies with alpha particles. Nobody talks about that. I have a piece in Fair that shows that only AP reported on alpha particles. Everybody else said that it requires special handling. Bull. It's not about the handling. It's about what's left after they fire them at a tank and it burns. So, we are fortunately still unable to use our nukes because of the mutual assured destruction that resulted from Ted's and Klaus Fuchs's spying. As awful as mutual assured destruction is, and Ted certainly and probably Fuchs too had no idea that that's what would happen. They thought, certainly Ted said they thought that, you know, if Russia got the bomb and prevented the U.S. from being able to use its bomb, that they'd both see that the stalemate was, you know, really real, and would ban the bomb the way, you know, germ warfare and chemical warfare was banned after World War I. It was a logical thought, but, you know, the madmen in Washington wanted to, they started building they started work on the hydrogen bomb before the war ended. And they started trying to industrialize production of the atomic bomb that they had before the war ended. And it was clear and was stated by Leslie Groves at a dinner of a bunch of senior scientists at Los Alamos that he said, you know that Germany was never the target purpose of this bomb. The target was controlling the Soviet Union. And that went around the camp like a wildfire. So, you know, that is the reality. And I think the reality is that MAD still exists. So even though Russia's army is not as frightening as and powerful as it was portrayed as by the Russians and by the Pentagon, they still have a huge stockpile of thermonuclear weapons and missiles that work quite well, you know, launching satellites and able to launch these bombs towards the U.S., which is a huge deterrent.
Well, now the book, A Spy for No Country, as I said, it's going to be released October 24th. How do people get their hands on that?
Well, it's listed already in Amazon and Powell Books, if you want to get a unionized place, and other bookstores, Barnes & Noble, as of that date. You know, you can get it that way, or you can go to your local bookstore and get it. You know, it'll be available.
Yeah, well, given our McCarthy times, I don't know if we can get it, especially up here in Canada, which it doesn't welcome communists anymore, I don't believe. But
you ought to be able to get it from those online sites. They're not checking your mail like that, I don't think.
Oh, no, of course they're not.
If they're doing mail covers, you might get on a list.
Heaven forbid. Well, or you could go to Dave's website, thiscan'tbehappening.net, and you've got links at the site too to the book under your bio and that, right, Dave?
Yeah, and I probably will put a gift of a book signed, when they're out and available. I can sell them myself because I can buy them at discount. And I can offer them as gifts to people who, you know, give, say, $100 to This Can't Be Happening and an autographed copy. So bear that in mind. But I haven't done it yet because I don't have the books.
Well, yeah, and it's a great project to support. You've been at it for a long time. Have you moved over? I'm sorry, I don't know this, but over to Substack and joined that sort of Substack crowd yet?
I keep trying. I can't figure it out. I'd like to monetize my writing, but you know they don't have a good help system, and I can't for the life of me figure out. I'm on Substack, but how to free, but how to subscribe and monetize it is beyond me.
Oh, it's in the settings. I'll send you something. Okay, Dave. Well, thanks a lot for coming on again and talking to us. This must be like the 50th time we've talked over the last. I think we started talking in 2004, Dave, if I remember right.
Yeah, that's right. And on this topic, you know, I've been working on this for 3.5 years, both the film and the book. And this one's coming together now. I'm very excited.
Well, I'm really happy for you, Dave.
I really appreciate you giving me a chance to talk about it early.
Well, this is my meat. I love to hear about brave people risking it all to do the right thing, as Ted Hall did and as you do and have done for so many years. So I really appreciate you taking your time to come on this little backwater show.
Thanks. Well, you know, Joan did say when she got to see the film at the Cambridge Film Festival last October, where she spoke from the stage, too, someone asked her, you know, what's the significance of what Ted did? And she said, I think the real significance of what he did is he showed what the enormous changes that one person can make.
Yeah. And how much change? Geez, what a world. The whole world would be different if he hadn't done this, God. I think.
Yeah, it certainly would.
Well, thanks again, Dave. And I want to also thank John Helmer from Dances with Bears for coming on. That's all I got for this week. Until the next time. Thanks again, Dave.
Thanks, Chris. Bye-bye.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.